In our studies, I've tried to impress upon your minds the importance of certain key passages to remember as we discuss the history and geography of the Bible. Some key passages give us things to hang our hat on, as it were, when we come over into the New Testament in terms of application to see fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies. And, of course, that helps us to strengthen our faith when we see that what God said centuries before has come to pass in vivid detail many years down the pike. Now, in that study, we have looked at passages such as Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. And, of course, that particular passage is the very first of the redemptive promises regarding the seed of woman that was to bruise the head of the serpent. And then we moved forward for many generations till we come to the time of Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. Now, I want you to tell me these chapters as we move forward. In Genesis chapter 12, we see three promises. What are they?
The land, seed, and nation.
All right, the land, seed, and nation. Let's get them in the order in which they are fulfilled. The nation promise, God said, I'll make of you a great nation, and then I'll give to you a certain land. And then we know that in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. Now we see that promise in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3. Make a mental note of that, or better yet, write that down, because I'm going to ask you that over and over and over. And then when we come to the time of Genesis chapter 22, Abraham is an old, old man. As God has promised him that he's going to make of him a great nation. Abraham doesn't have any children. But finally, in Genesis chapter 21, I believe it is, Isaac is born, and God instructs Abraham in Genesis 22 to take him upon the mountain and offer him there for sacrifice. And Abraham did. He believed God, the New Testament tells us. What was it that Abraham did? He took his son Isaac, and what did he do, and how did he reason? All right, he took him up there and prepared to sacrifice him. He drew back the knife. Angel of the Lord stayed his hand, and you know this. And then again, in Genesis chapter 22, God reminded him that in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. Now, the bruising of the head of the serpent by the seed of woman, and the blessing all families of the earth through the seed of Abraham. Who is that seed? Jesus, and we know that how?
Galatians 3.
16. That's right.
You know, yeah, which verse?
Galatians 3, verse 16. That's right. Now, I'm going to ping on you for these things. So if you hear something and it doesn't ring a bell to you, write it down, because we're going to be going over this and over this and over this. I want you to learn. Now, when we leave Genesis chapter 22, we come forward to Genesis chapter 49. Genesis chapter 49. And in verse 10, we see yet a little bit more detail regarding God's promise involving the scheme of redemption. What is it that we find in Genesis chapter 49, verse 10? Write that one down too. We want that in our list. It's important to 2 Samuel 7.
Yes. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the king of the people.
All right, the scepter would not depart out of the hand of Judah. What's a scepter?
A sign of kingship.
All right, a sign of kingship. The right to rule would not depart out of the hand of Judah. Now, through the process of all of this, we've noted that the promise was initially made to Abraham. Abraham had a son, Isaac. The promises, plural, the three, were repeated to Isaac where? Genesis 26 to Isaac. And then Isaac had two sons. What were their names? Jacob and Esau. The promise then was extended, all three of them, to Jacob. And you know I'm going to ask you, Joey, where? Genesis chapter 28, beginning about verse 13. Genesis chapter 28. In thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. That just keeps being repeated. And then as we come to Genesis 49, verse 10, the scepter would not depart out of the hand Judah, what we see is that Jacob had 12 sons. One of those sons' name was Judah. And God had selected Judah to be the one through whom all this would come to pass. Now, look, if you will, from the time of Genesis 3 to the time of Genesis chapter 49, a lot of years have transpired. But we continue to see more specifics being given relative to that promise. Now, that closes the book of Genesis with chapter 50 and Joseph's reminder to the people that he's about to die, and we know his body then was embalmed but not buried in Egypt. He made preparations for the children of Israel to bring him up out of Egypt. Why? Where was it that Joseph was going to be buried? In the land of Canaan. How did Joseph know those people were going to go to the land of Canaan? Well, he was familiar, you see, with these three promises. That in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. He knew that the descendants of Abraham would live in the land of Canaan. And he also knew that these descendants were growing into a great and a mighty nation. So you want to write that down. Genesis chapter 50, the last paragraph, last three or four verses of that chapter. Now, when you begin the book of Exodus, what's the book of Exodus about? All right, the coming out of Egyptian bondage. The word Exodus is to exit, and they're coming out of the land of Egypt. Now, in the coming out, of course, we read about the plagues. We won't take the time to discuss that. That's not particularly relevant to the thing that I want to discuss with you this morning. But we do know that as they came out and came to the foot of Mount Sinai, God called them a holy nation. This passage you want in your list. What is it?
Exodus
19. Verses 5 and 6. God Himself called them a holy nation. Easy way to remember that. That's right on the preface of the giving of the Ten Commandments, which you'll read in Exodus chapter 20, given to those who came up out of the land of Egypt, beginning in verse 1. Now, with the giving of the law is given to that holy nation. Make a big check mark there. The nation promise is fulfilled. Exodus chapter 19, verses 5 and 6. During this time of wilderness wandering, Moses tells them, if you worship and serve idols, you'll be destroyed. God will take you out of the land that He has promised to give you. Let's look at our passages. What are they? Deuteronomy 4, 8, 28 through 30. All right, 28 through 30. All right, we want to note those. Write that down. Be familiar with them. Deuteronomy 28 through 30. In all of those passages, if you worship and serve idols, God will destroy you. All right, mark the end now. We're through with Exodus. Come to the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 34. Deuteronomy chapter 34, write that down. We find that Moses is about to die. He's privileged to view the land. Where is he? Mount Nebo, that's right. We know that he sees the land to the north, to the west, and to the south or southwest, and is privileged to see the land because God said, this is the land that I promised to give unto the fathers. But you'll not go over in it. Now that's Deuteronomy chapter 34. And Moses saw it. I believe that's verse 4. He saw that land. And the hand of God buried him at a ripe old age. I forget how old he was. 120, I believe. His eye was not dim, nor was his strength abated. Now when we look at the death of Moses, now we've got a new leader. The book of Joshua. What's it about?
Joshua.
About Joshua. Reach over and smack it. All right. Pardon me? I didn't hear. All right, God is with us, yes. The taking of the land. When you think of the book of Joshua, you think about Joshua. But you think about what Joshua did. Joshua led them in the conquest of the land. Okay? That's what the book of Joshua is about. Now, when you come to Joshua chapter 11, what is it? Verse 31? Randy, check me on that, I believe. We learned that all of the land has been conquered. Joshua chapter 11. I believe it's verse 31. It's the last verse of that chapter.
23.
Pardon me?
23 is the last verse in that Joshua 11.
Okay, then that's what it is. Joshua chapter 11, verse 23. Would you read that for me, please? I want to be sure I've got the right verse.
But Joshua took the whole land according to all that Jehovah spake unto Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance unto Israel according to their divisions by their tribes, and the land had rest from war.
All right, very good. Write that down. Joshua 11, verse 23. The land has been conquered. Now, when you begin in chapter 12, we see a review of what's being done and then a distribution of the land among the tribes. But when you come to Joshua chapter 21, write that down, beginning in verse 43. Joshua chapter 21, verse 43. What does Joshua tell them about the land? Larry, you have that for me, please? Joshua 21, verse 43, beginning. Swear unto your fathers. So now we know what land. And you possessed it. You dwell in it. Has anything about that promise fallen short?
No.
Joshua said, all came to pass. You see that? Verse 44. Now, as you continue in that text, you'll see that. But then I want you to write down Joshua chapter 23. Joshua chapter 23. Beginning in verse 14, 15, and 16. Because there again we find that Joshua tells him everything that God promised relative to the land, he did. But then in verse 16, he tells them what? Same thing Moses told them.
When you transgress.
When you transgress, what's going to happen?
You'll lose it.
You're going to lose it. You're going to lose it. Now, I want you to write those passages down. We're going to go over and over and over and over and over and over them because I want us to know them. Okay? The land promise has been fulfilled. But way back now in the time when Moses was leading them up out of the land of Israel, out of the land of Egypt, we know that he told them that the day will come when you will ask for a king. Passage. Deuteronomy. 17. Deuteronomy 17. I want you to write that one down. The day will come when you will ask for a king. Deuteronomy chapter 17. Now,
I was going to say that one there and the one before when it says when you worship idols, it's not if.
That's correct.
It's if. It's dedicated tense, it's better for when.
Yes, exactly right. But in Deuteronomy chapter 17, beginning in verse 14, on to the end of the chapter through verse 20, you'll see that Moses tells them, you're going to ask for a king. And when you do, here's the kind of king that you are to appoint. Now, many years down the pike, and get the timeline somewhat fixed in your mind from the time of Moses when he led them up out of the land of Egypt to the time of the giving of the law and then to the time of him bringing them to Kadesh Barnea and then the sending in of the spies and their evil report that didn't go in. Now you've got to add 40 years to that time. You've got to add the period of the conquest to that time under the leadership of Joshua. And you've got to add to that now the period of the judges, which was approximately 300 years. And then you have the last of the judges, Samuel. And the people then come to Samuel and they say, your kids aren't good. They don't follow your teaching. And so we want a king. about how much time has passed since Moses, way back there, said, the day's going to come and you're going to ask for a king.
About
400 years. That's a long time. But Moses already told them. You see, if they were familiar with their history at all, they would know Moses already told you that. And so they asked for a king. First king is King Saul. And where are we in the text? They asked for a king. Where?
1 Samuel 8.
Write that down. 1 Samuel 8. The people asked for a king. You can write that right out there beside it. Deuteronomy chapter 17, where Moses told them, the day's going to come when you'll ask for a king. 1 Samuel 8, they asked for a king. Saul is appointed to be king. Saul was very humble when he started out, but then he became very arrogant. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, you recall how Samuel had told him, you wait in Gilgal till I come. Offer the sacrifice, and we'll beseech the Lord on behalf of you as you engage the Philistine. Well, he couldn't wait. And he went ahead and offered the sacrifice, and when Samuel came, he said, I forced myself to do that. Alright? Then we learn that in 1 Samuel 15, these are passages you need to write down. If you're making somewhat of an outline, I should do this on the board where you have it in order. But under the heading of King Saul, you write down 1 Samuel chapter 15. And what did King Saul do in 1 Samuel 15?
More what he didn't do.
And more what he didn't do, yeah.
He didn't destroy the Amalekites like he was told to.
He did not destroy the Amalekites, but he brought back the best of the Amalekites, including their animals, to offer as a sacrifice unto the Lord. And Samuel told him, what you have done is rebellion.
Question. We see passages where the people said, we want a king like the nations round about us, and God basically said, I'm paraphrasing here grossly, no, trust me, you don't want a king, you want me to be your king. And yet, when they insisted and had a king, we see God saying, okay, I'm going to choose that king. I make a comment on that. I find it a little strange that God is saying, no, don't do that, but if you're going to do it, I'm going to be playing a part in the choice and all of that kind of thing. I just find it a little peculiar.
All right, what we see in that, I think, and a very brief comment, is the providence of God. God had already told them, the day's going to come and you'll ask for a king.
And we know God never condoned the idea of having a king.
No, he did not want them to have a king. We see evidence overwhelming of that in 1 Samuel 8, that God did not want them to have a king. But their insistence. Let me illustrate the point. Sometimes we do this with our children to try to drive home the lesson. They've asked the same question several times. We've already answered the question. The answer is no. Do you ever get to the point where in exasperation you say, all right, go ahead. Now, is that what we really want? No. But are we teaching a lesson? We're trying to. We're trying to show the consequences.
I guess
the superiority.
I guess I would have assumed that God's response would have been, I don't condone that, so if you're going to have a king, that's on you. You choose it. And yet we see God saying, I'm going to choose the king.
Well, yeah.
I just find him a little curious. So.
Yes. Well, he wants to show them what can happen. Yeah. And I think we can see in the illustration of Saul, here's one that starts out humble, but we see a change. This is what's often power and money and authority. And so what that does to somebody. And it did it to King Saul. Yeah. And there are all kinds of ramifications. We speculate on that. But the answer to the question was, no, don't want you to have a king, but go ahead and appoint one.
But if you're going to have one, I'm going to use this situation to teach you a lesson. It sounds like that's what you're saying.
That's repeated over and over. Consider a little further down the pipe. We're venturing off our subject, but consider just a little further down the pipe with Balak and Balaam. You remember how that Balak, king of the Moabites, had heard what the Israelites are doing, and he wants Balaam to curse the people of God. And Balaam told him, said, I can't do any more or less what God said. And furthermore, let me inquire of God and see whether God even wants me to go. And God said, no. And then he came back with greater offerings and let me inquire again. God said, all right, go. Now, was it the will of God that he go? No. He didn't want his people cursed. But he went. And now here's what happened. So here's the lesson learned.
I think I would agree with your Providence remark, it seems that when you go back and you look at the prophecy of Jacob, the prophecy of Israel, that the scepter would not depart from Judah. Well, here's the scepter. The very first scepter is not given to Judah.
No.
It's given to Benjamin.
Yes.
To the son of Benjamin. And yet, that was to bring about the kingship of David.
Yes.
And David, you know, we saw how that whole story played out. How David became his armor bearer. How David became trusted. How David was, you know, David increased and Saul decreased. And so it really brought about the first of the scepter going to Judah.
That's right, which brings up all kinds of challenging questions about how that the kingdom could have been established with Saul.
Right.
God said it could.
But again, the providence of God, the prophecy of Jacob was that the scepter would be Judah's.
And so it was. And here the events play out.
And then, and then Christ, in the lineage, the direct lineage of David.
That's correct. Yes, that's correct. So, therein is some elements involved in the answer to your question. Now, we were talking about the appointment of King Saul. I want you to remember a segment of time. King Saul, the next king was King David, and then his son, King Solomon. Lots of things to talk about in that interim. But with those three kings, we're going to identify that period of time as the United Kingdom. United Kingdom because we have all of Israel being ruled under one king. Now, I understand the succession of this one and then this one. This, but we have a king ruling Israel. The kingdom is united with Rehoboam, the son of King Solomon. The kingdom is divided. We have the northern 10 tribes and the southern 2 tribes. And now we have a separate set of kings and a separate set of prophets that we'll talk about when we get to that period. But what we want to see is that there's a fork that occurs after Rehoboam, resulting in the divided kingdom. Now, I'm following a thought here, so stay with me. All right.
One thing that's always surprising is we see that the two kingdoms not only warring with neighboring nations, there's occasions where they're actually warring with themselves.
Sure.
And you would think that they would, if they knew their history at all, if they were remotely privy to their industry, history, you would think that they would be saying, wait a minute, aren't we supposed to be on the same side here? You know, it amazes me that they're even warring amongst themselves, knowing that they God brought them out of Egypt, and they should be viewing themselves as brothers, you know, in the kingdom and not enemies.
Well, that's true. Of course, the question is legitimate and has to be asked, who is on the Lord's side?
Right.
And neither of them ultimately were, as it turns out. But anyhow, to follow our thread, we're talking about King Saul. King Saul rebelled. God sought a king after God's own heart. And of course, the next king then was David, as we see on the screen. Now, to David of the lineage of Judah, we bring ourselves now to 2 Samuel chapter 7. I was mentioning to someone, I think perhaps Richard, this morning, that 2 Samuel chapter 7 is a most fascinating chapter. Of Old Testament chapters, I want you to jot this down in your list. Put a big asterisk beside it. A very important landmark chapter. One I want you to remember relative to the development of the scheme of redemption. Remember in Genesis 49, verse 10, if you're drawing arrows, put this one out beside of that. The scepter would not depart out of the hand of Judah. David is of the lineage of Judah. And to David, it is said in 2 Samuel chapter 7, some things that we want to take note of. Now, in 2 Samuel chapter 7, we see David's desire to build God a house. David says, here I've conquered the city of Jerusalem, a mighty fine city it is, and I have built me a fine house that's out of cedar, and here is the so-called house of God. What was it? It was a tent. Yes, it was a tent in which was housed the Ark of the Covenant. And God said, who even said I wanted a house? Nobody said that I wanted a big fine house. Now, the thing about that is that as we come into the New Testament in Acts chapter 17, when the Apostle Paul came into the city of Athens, what did he behold when he came into the city? It was filled with what? Idols. And where were the idols housed? In temples. Fine, elaborate, expensive structures. And some of the ruins of those structures you can still see. Go online and search Athens, and you can see where these things were and see the magnificent ruins of them. And you figure into that then the investment of money, the investment of time, the investment of labor that the Athenians had invested in these idolatrous temples. And one of the points that the Apostle Paul made when he came into the city is, God does not dwell in temples made with hands. Now, was God in the presence of the Israelites without temple? Sure was. Had he done great and marvelous things for them without a temple? Sure had. So why does David think that God would surely be unhappy because I live in a nice house and God doesn't have a temple?
He's thinking like a man.
That's right. But regarding this temple, I want you to look now in chapter 7. 2 Samuel chapter 7. Reading beginning in verse 11. Verse 11. He said, "And as from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and I will cease, or rather I will cause thee to rest from all thine enemies. Moreover, Jehovah telleth thee that Jehovah will make thee a house. When thy days are fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee that shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chastise him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men, but my loving kindness shall not depart from him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before thee. And thy house and thy kingdom shall be made sure forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever. According to all these words and according to all this vision, so did Nathan speak unto David." Let me just say that this is a biggie. I want you to underscore this passage and understand its importance. When God said that I will establish your house, we want to note that as we come down into the New Testament, and I'm just going to introduce this here because we're going to spend a good bit of time on it in just a moment. But in Acts chapter 2, in verses 30 through verse 33, we see much of this Old Testament text alluded to, if not quoted, in verses 30 through verse 33. As the Apostle Peter speaks concerning the coronation or the crowning of Jesus as king on David's throne. Now, David spent much of his lifetime gathering riches that his son Solomon would use to build a literal temple in the city of Jerusalem. But David was not privileged to build a temple. But what was told to David is that your son will build a house. Your son will build a temple. Now, we know that in 1 Chronicles, we talked about this in our study Wednesday night, and I'm going to encourage you to take notes on these two or three charts because I want you to be well familiar with these passages. David's son Solomon is named to be the one who would build this house. In the text of 2 Samuel 7, he is not named. But we do know that the house would be built. Solomon is named in these passages to help us to see who would be the son that would build the house. David applies this to Solomon. But be it understood that when God said, "I will establish your house," he's not talking about a physical building. He's talking about David's dynasty. your lineage. Going back to Genesis 49, verse 10, the scepter would not depart out of the hand of Judah. The house of David would be established. This lineage, this dynasty would be established. Interestingly enough, from this point on, when we read of the kings in Jerusalem, they are all of the lineage of David.
Question. In verse 14, when he says, I will be his father, and he shall be my son, we have to conclude, don't we, at that point, that he's still referring to Solomon. Because of the next verse is, if he commits an iniquity, which doesn't apply to him.
He is referring to Solomon, and he is referring to those who would be the descendants of Solomon. What we see is the kingship personified. But what we also see is this passage quoted in the New Testament. An application is made to the Son of God. Look at Hebrews chapter 1. Hebrews chapter 1. Now, bear in mind, we're jumping ahead just a little bit. In Hebrews chapter 1, in verse 5. But you'll note that the context of Hebrews chapter 1 is to show the superiority of the Son of God over the angels, to show that He's better. But in verse 5, he said, For unto which of the angels said he at any time, Thou art my son, this day have I begotten thee. And again, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. Where are those words? Over here in 2 Samuel 7. Now who does the Hebrew writer apply them to?
Jesus.
To Jesus.
And yet, in the 2 Samuel passage, when he says, I will be his father, and he shall be my son, if he commits iniquity... So it's talking about the same person there, so it can't be a reference to Jesus when he says that he commits iniquity. So we have to conclude that he will be my son as a reference to Solomon and his physical kings, the physical kings that were the people that would succeed Solomon.
Yes, it would have application to the physical kings that would succeed Solomon, but let's not preclude the possibility of the application to the Son of God. What we want to see in this passage, we look at Jesus and we say, well, Jesus didn't sin, so it can't have application to Jesus. Wait just a minute. Are we then suggesting that it was impossible for Jesus to sin? See, we don't want to go there. We don't want to go there. He was tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. Are we suggesting that it was not possible for Him to sin? See, we don't want to raise that issue. Because then we come to the conclusion that He was not tempted in all points like as we are. Because there was a shield in front of Him. He couldn't be reached.
So you think in 2 Samuel it says if He commits iniquity, it could also be a reference to Jesus?
I think the application of Hebrews chapter 1 would force us to that conclusion.
Okay.
It would force us to that conclusion. Now that becomes a debatable issue, I understand. But it would force us to that conclusion. Yes.
16
Yes, verse 16 is talking about the establishment of the throne of David, which is obviously the establishment of the authority of Christ. Now, we're getting several things on the plate. Let's back up and get them in order. What we want to see is that David's lineage ruled for about 400 years, the physical lineage of David. Until we come to the time of Coniah. This brings us to the book of Jeremiah, where Jeremiah is a prophet to the people of Judah. And at the time that Jeremiah prophesies to these people, look at what he says about the lineage of David ruling on an earthly throne. Turn to Jeremiah chapter 22. This is a very important passage. You want this one in your list. Jeremiah chapter 22. Jeremiah chapter 22. Now, all of you, I'm going to pick on Peggy Kling. She's not here even to defend herself. Bless her heart. But we were studying through some of these things, and we noted that there are kings that are sometimes called two or three names. Same man. Identified by two or three names. And then sometimes another man who wears one of those names. And it gets confusing in this particular period of time. But in Jeremiah chapter 22, the writer is telling us about a man named Coniah. You see that in verse 24? Coniah. He's identified as the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. What does that tell us about who Coniah is? What's his lineage? He's from David. He's from the lineage of David. It says, king of Judah, were the signet upon my right hand, yet I would pluck it, pluck thee thence, and I will give it into the hand of them, verse 25, that seek thy life, and into the hand of them of whom thou art afraid, even into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and unto the king of the Chaldeans. And I will cast thee out, and thy mother that bare thee, into another country where ye were not born, and there shall ye die. But to the land whereunto their soul longeth to return, thither shall they not return. Is this man, Coniah, a despised, broken vessel? He is a vessel wherein none delighteth. Wherefore they are they cast out, he and his seed, and are cast into the land which they know not. O earth, 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 hear the word of Jehovah. Thus saith Jehovah, write ye this man childless, a man that shall not prosper in his days, for no more shall a man of his seed prosper, sitting upon the throne of David and ruling in Judah. Now, our time is just getting quickly away, far too fast. But as we look at this Old Testament prophecy of Jeremiah, what's going to happen to the lineage of this man, Coniah, who is of the lineage of David, of the lineage of Judah? What's going to happen to the lineage of the kings ruling and reigning on the throne of David in Jerusalem? It's going to stop. Not going to be nary another one. Now why? What's about to happen to Judah?
Carried away to Babylon.
Carried away into Babylonian captivity. Even upon their return, is there going to be a king like there has been? Never again going to be that. Now, go back to 2 Samuel chapter 7. 2 Samuel chapter 7. Hold that thought. Let's go right back there and see what God said unto David through Nathan. 2 Samuel 7. In 2 Samuel 7, God said, Joey, following on the heels of what you just said, He said, I will be his father, verse 14, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before thee. What happened to the lineage of Saul?
It was ended.
No more kings from Saul. No more sons and grandsons and great-grandsons. His lineage was cut off from the face of the earth. What does God say to David? Your lineage is going to be cut off from the face of the earth? No. No. Some of your lineage is going to do bad things. Some of your lineage is going to be serving as kings. They'll do bad things. What's going to happen to them? All right, there's going to be a remnant, but what's going to happen to those who do bad things? Going to be punished. That's right. I will chasten them with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of the men. What happened to the children of Judah? Because of their worship of idols. They were taken captives. Babylonian captivity, you see. But does that mean that the lineage of David was cut off? No, no. Lineage of David was not cut off. Now, as you continue in this text, he says in verse 16, And thy house and thy kingdom shall be made sure forever before thee, thy throne shall be established forever. How is it now that though the lineage of David is going to include some folks, including Coniah and Jehoiakim, his father, who did bad things that resulted in them being taken into Babylonian captivity, yet how is it that the throne of David would be established forever? Christ. Christ. Now we want to put all that together and see how that comes to pass. Look at 2 Chronicles chapter 21. I said in previous studies that I want you to read the Kings and the Chronicles together because they help us considerably. In 2 Chronicles chapter 21. 2 Chronicles chapter 21. In verse 6 and 7. It tells us, and he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, as did the house of Ahab. For he had the daughter of Ahab to wife. Now notice we're talking about King Jehoram, who was a king in Judah, and he's described as a very wicked king. But he's of the right lineage. He's of the lineage of David. But he has to wife the daughter of Ahab, who you recall was a king in Israel. Very wicked king. It says in verse 7, "Howbeit Jehovah would not destroy the house of David because of the covenant that he made with David, and as he promised to give a lamp to him and to his children always." Now, even though Jehoram was a very wicked king in Judah, had a very wicked wife, the daughter of Ahab, God said, "I won't destroy the lineage of David." Why? Because I made a promise to David. "I'm going to establish thy throne forever." Now, if God had just cut that off, then the coming of Christ of the lineage of David would not have been. He would not have fulfilled his promise. That is right. But what you're seeing is the years and the events and the providence of God bringing all this to pass. Now, when we talk about this kingdom being established forever, we're not talking about just an earthly lineage of David, are we? That's not what we're talking about. This takes us back, you see, to Genesis 3:15. Rings a bell, doesn't it? The seed of woman bruise the head of the serpent. Genesis 12, "In thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed." Genesis 26:28. Genesis 49:10. "Scepter not depart from the hand of Judah." The rulership, the right to rule, authority. Well, now we've talked about the Psalms. Let's turn to Psalms chapter 89. We know that David wrote most of the Psalms, but yet not all of them. In Psalms chapter 89, we see that Ethan, the Ezraite, flourished during the days of David and Solomon. And let's see what he had to say about this promise. Chapter 89, Psalms chapter 89. And if you'll note, beginning in verse 28, very quickly, it says, "My loving kindness will I keep for him forevermore, and my covenant shall stand fast with him. His seed also will I make to endure forever, his throne as the days of heaven." Drop down, if you will, to verse 33 for sake of time. He said, "But my loving kindness will I not utterly take from him, nor suffer my faithfulness to fail. My covenant will I not break, nor alter the thing that is gone out of my lips. Once have I sworn by my holiness, I will not lie unto David. His seed shall endure forever, and his throne as the sun before me. It shall be established forever as the moon, and as the faithful witness in the sky." Dropping down to verse 47, "Oh, remember how short my time is. For what vanity hast thou created all the children of men? What man is he that shall live and shall not see death? And shall deliver, or that shall deliver his soul from the power of Sheol." Wait a minute. What is it that this psalmist is telling us about the throne of David going to be established? The thing that God said to David is not going to fail. When you go back and look at verses 3 and 4. "Thou hast taken away all thy wrath. Thou hast turned thyself from fierceness of thine anger. Turn us, O God, of our salvation, and cause thine indignation toward us to cease." The throne of David is certainly to be established. David was anointed and his throne established in the verses that we read. His seed and his throne to be established forever in the verses that we read.
So, what appears on the surface to maybe be contradictory, I'm carefully breaking it up, appears to be 2 Samuel 7 and Jeremiah 22. If you you just read those two sections, you go, what, they're opposed to each other. But we see the wisdom and power of God in that, how God accomplished that. Basically converting the kingdom from a physical kingdom to a spiritual kingdom. And that's how he accomplished what, on the surface, seems to be a contradiction, but in fact isn't.
Yeah. Bruce?
Yeah, verse 27 says that I will also make him my firstborn higher than the kings of the earth.
All right. That's right. That's right. So we're talking about a whole lot more than just simply an earthly lineage. Now, in Psalms 132, we talked about, I believe, Wednesday night, David's desire to build a house in verses 1 through 5. We noted that David understood that one of the fruit of his loins would sit upon his throne. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Acts chapter 2 in verse 30. David foreseeing this. What was he foreseeing? Now, don't get discouraged with the multitude of these passages, because there are many of them. But to hammer this point home, when we think about this lineage, Psalm 16. Psalm 16, 1,000 years before Jesus came. In Psalms chapter 16, look if you will, beginning in verse, well, the whole chapter, but if you'll note, beginning in verse 10, verse 9, it says, "Therefore my heart is glad, and my glory rejoiceth. My flesh also shall dwell in safety, for thou wilt not leave my soul to Sheol, neither wilt thou give or suffer thy Holy One to see corruption." We know where that's from, don't we? Well, we know where that occurs in Acts chapter 2. As the Apostle Peter is quoting from this Old Testament prophecy of David and establishing that Jesus would be raised from the dead. Now, David wrote, knowing that one of his lineage would sit upon his throne. But yet also we see his lineage, as far as sitting upon his throne is concerned, ended with Coniah as a temporal throne. But yet the Apostle Peter affirms that Christ is now seated on David's throne at the right hand of God. Now, that helps us to see the transition, as you talked about.
That has to be a spiritual.
Oh, it has to be.
Jesus never physically sat on the throne.
No.
So that has to be a reference to the kingdom and the throne of David now being a spiritual metaphor.
Exactly right. Look at Psalms 110. Don't I have about another 15 minutes?
Nope.
Well, I tell you what. Please be back Wednesday night, because I want you to look at the text of Acts chapter 2 in some detail in reference to Psalms 110. And I also want you to look at the text of Acts chapter 15 in reference to the prophecy of Amos from Amos chapter 9. Okay? And we'll see how that Amos prophesied the restoration of the throne of David, the restoration of Israel. And we see that that was to be done in Christ. Now, there's the link between Coniah and Jesus. We've got a period of time here, a bookend period of time, from Coniah, physical kings, where there are no kings sitting on the throne. And then we have the resurrection of Jesus, who is a spiritual king, sitting upon the throne. And in Acts chapter 15... James said, Amos said this would happen, and here it is.
And it's still a descendant of David, which means that God fulfilled the promise.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So, if you can jot that down right quick, you'll be ahead in our study on Wednesday night. Okay? I'll leave that up there for just a moment.